Hello, everybody. Welcome to Derek's Live Chat Show. In the fifth month of this, we never thought this would be going on so long, but it's absolutely fantastic. And I want to welcome all our guests that have stayed with us. If you're watching this on YouTube, welcome. Tonight, I've got Jeremy Wilson with me. Jeremy and I have known each other for a number of years, and Jeremy's always done something which is usually quite different to me. We worked together in a financial institution, and then Jeremy became the chairman of Bloomsbury Publishing. Bloomsbury Publishing is, of course, the publishing company that owns all the rights to J.K. Rowling books, which must have been a really exciting time for you, Jeremy. But now you're chairman of the Whitechapel think tank. And when we've been discussing the think tank, and we've been talking about cryptocurrencies and all these complicated things that I don't even pretend to understand, you said you'd come on, explain it to me and to my guests. So, Jeremy, thanks so much for joining me and for joining the guests.
It's a pleasure. I'm delighted to be with you, Derek. Thank you.
The first question, Jeremy, is what is the Whitechapel think tank?
Okay, well, before I answer, Derek, just a quick one. Especially since most people are now muted. Tell me, what is the most used phrase in 2020?
I don't know.
No, and I was just looking
at China.
No. Oh. The most used phrase in 2020 is "you're on mute." Anyway.
Okay, I didn't know that. Thank you.
I picked that up this morning and I thought I need to pass that on to somebody.
Yeah, well, that'll be very useful. I'll use that on my newsletter next week. Anything else I need to know?
I think it'll do for the moment. I probably ought to answer your question, Derek. We don't have a great deal of time, I know. So the Whitechapel Think Tank was formed about 5 years ago now, after I'd been in Toronto for Barclays. And I found myself sitting next to a young entrepreneur who used to work for JP Morgan and then had left and set up a business on his own, sold that to the Israelis. And the two of us had been talking at a World Economic Forum about something called distributed ledger technologies and blockchain. And when I got back to London, I thought, this sounds pretty significant. We ought to do something about it. So I rang John Edge, this young entrepreneur, and he said, and I said to him, this is of such significance. I think we ought to get the government, the regulators, and the private sector, including the startups and also the big incumbents, together in a room, at the very least, just to understand what's going on. And that was really, Derek, that was the foundation of the Whitechapel Think Tank. It then became a forum for all of those constituencies, first of all, to understand what it was, and then increasingly to take forward some of the component bits which are building themselves into the sort of digital infrastructure of the planet.
Digital infrastructure of the planet. I can't even say it without putting my teeth back in. But so blockchain, Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies. I don't understand too much about this. I read about it in the Financial Times. I see people have punts on Bitcoin, but that's only the same as having a punt on the foreign exchanges or on the stock market, isn't it? What's it all about? And I think you told me China are the leaders in this, which is another concern.
Yeah, I mean, we could probably take months or weeks or even hours just to talk through the whole story around the technologies, the blockchain technology, and includes the others, artificial intelligence and robotics and so on and so forth. But a good place to start, actually, and to focus, which is really where this thing has started to focus itself quite sharply, is on what are now called digital currencies. Now, the first manifestation of a digital currency, which is a new species of currency, is probably the best way to describe that. And maybe we can come on to the functionality and what it actually does. Why is it different? Why do we need something like that in a minute or two?
Sure.
But the first manifestation of that was Bitcoin. Now, the motivations behind Bitcoin were bluntly, in my personal opinion, completely unrealistic. And that was to introduce total anonymity, so people could use a global currency to do what they will, where they will, and whenever they will. Which, of course, has major implications for money supply management of individual economies and independent economic independence of sovereign states. So not surprisingly, the entire governance community around the world rose up in arms. That's probably too strong a sense, but everything around it said, look, we don't think we can allow this. However, the cat was out of the bag by then. The technology had been introduced. It clearly was possible to do. And like all things with technology, which potentially offers groundbreaking solutions, you can't stop it once it's started. So the next thing that happened was that Facebook introduced something called Libra. And they announced something where they said, well, this is not full anonymity and all the other bits and pieces that Bitcoin is offering, but it is a currency for use within our own network. I can't remember what the size of the Facebook network is, but of course it's in billions.
Massive.
And consequently, the central bank said, well, we can't have that either. But what's happened since then is that the central banks all over the world, because they realize you can't stop this, are now setting up their own what are called central bank digital currencies. CBDCs, you might see them referred to, and you will increasingly see them referred to as that. And these are the big central banks, as well as some of the more entrepreneurial ones. So the Bank of England is right there in the thick of it. So is the People's Bank of China. Funnily enough, the Federal Reserve and the United States, not quite so advanced, but they're now working on it, and the private sector is pushing something forward. Tim, you may know more about this than me, but there are some very interesting projects. Anyway, Derek, in simple terms, we've got something which is now moving its way. I can't think of another two words that I can use, really. They've only just occurred to me anyway. They are building themselves into the digital infrastructure, the financial infrastructure of the world. This is very early days, and it has been picked up by the custodians of society because we realize it's unstoppable. And as we all know, money is too toxic to leave in the hands of cavaniers, of buccaneers, and the criminal fraternity, basically. Does that help?
But tell me, Jeremy, the first two things that came into my mind were tax avoidance, and we got a couple of accountants on the call, and money laundering. Surely, if you've got a digital currency with nowhere to track it, then all the money laundering people are going to buy Bitcoin or whatever the digital currency is. Is that the case?
Well, I mean, yes and no, and to a large extent, no, Derek, because that's where the underlying technology, distributed ledger technologies or blockchain technologies, become very important. In really simple terms, and I'm perhaps oversimplifying this, there are plenty of people who would pick me up for it. But in very, very simple terms, instead of using one database with all the flaws that might creep into that database, what distributed ledger technologies do is they use a multitude of different databases, all cross-checking against each other. Now, when you do that, you get a much higher degree of what's called trust, of course, that the information that you're picking up is truly true. And so it also means that you can use databases which belong to the custodians of society, the regulators, all the anti-money laundering machinery that is now operative pretty well across the world, actually, to be able to contribute to any particular transaction. Now, it's ahead of its time at the moment, but I suspect what will happen is that if this currency does start getting used, it'll get used in a way that includes all the key stakeholders to ensure that that currency is being used in any transaction between an individual who is who she or he says he is, who is bona fide and not a criminal on both sides of the transaction, and probably carry a lot of information as well about the product or the service itself. This is absolutely transformational in my view, even if it takes a decade for us to move from where we are now to where I think we're clearly headed.
Now, you told me that one of the concerns of the Whitechapel think tank was that China is ahead of the game. Again, on all the worries, China All the other things we're talking about that we're hearing about, Justin's newsletter, in my newsletter this morning, etc. You said they're testing this in 8 cities, I think. Was that correct?
Yeah, I believe the number now using these currencies in a trial and experimental basis is about 50 million people. Now, that's within China. They are also beginning to deploy it across what most people probably heard of, the Belt and Road. The Belt and Road is these are my words, is China's overt efforts to ensure and protect its growing economic dominance along its major trade routes where it can. But they're particularly along areas where they see are going to be important to them for the accessibility to the resources they need. So the Belt and Road, if you haven't come across it, effectively runs across from China west to sort of Central Europe, through the Middle East, down to Africa and throughout Africa. But it also has components of it in South America as well.
Oh, wow.
You don't hear much about it in Europe, although there are clearly projects that are related to it within Europe. It's to my mind, it's the equivalent of the Romans when they were extending their empire across the world and what they chose to do in, you know, building major infrastructure projects here, there and everywhere. But it's more sophisticated than that. Now, what the Chinese have realized is that because we are in the early stages of a major technological revolution, that the technological capabilities that may be accessible to them in order to be able to extend this influence and power are worth taking some strong leadership positions on. And so when it came to, and this is purely inference on my part, I've got nothing to demonstrate it, but when it came to, no evidence to demonstrate it, but when it came to the awareness of a new currency and the realization too that as China's economic influence and power grew and grew, so too did the importance and relevance, potential relevance of its currency. And yet, of course, as we all know, the world's reserve currency is the US dollar.
Mm.
So I think China have thought to themselves, well, somehow or another, we've got to get our own currency recognized at the same status, increasingly so, as the US dollar. And bluntly, they've said, we can probably use this new form of currency to help us down that road. So they are, in my view, 5 to 10 years ahead of almost everybody else in its development, which doesn't mean to say that everybody else won't catch up, but it just shows you that we talked about the numbers just now, Derek, the scale and the vision that exists in how you exploit all the technological dimensions that we're facing for your own advantage going forward.
Thanks, Jeremy. There's a few questions in the chat box, but I'll come back to those later, if I may. You said to me when we were talking that there were 3 major issues in the world at the moment. One was technology, which we've talked about. Number 2 was climate change. And number 3 was the geopolitical pressures that are going on. Clearly, geopolitical is China. And Mr. Trump is clearly upset with China and doing a few things about it. Is this Bitcoin just part of it, or is it the fact that they're building infrastructure projects all over the world and now going electronic as well?
Yeah, I think one has to go up a level or two beyond that, Derek, to be honest with you. I mean, I think to me and my simple brain, periods in the history of humankind where economic power has shifted from one constituency to the next. You could call it civilizations have risen, waxed and waned. And that there is a strong argument developing that we're witnessing something like that at the moment. And certainly the economic capacity of China is now of sufficient size for China to be beginning to say, well, look, this needs to be recognized. And I think also if you're the power that is being challenged, your inclination is, first of all, probably to accept it and not even realize what's afoot, and then to resist it. And I think that's what we've got. So the answer to your last bit of that question, which was, how do they see these currencies, these digital currencies? I think that is simply part of the armory that they will deploy as they seek to consolidate their position globally over the course of the next two or three decades.
It's very interesting, some of the things that were going on, because in the Financial Times on Saturday, it said it was interesting that China had bought virtually every West Midlands football club. And the reason for that might be that they realise with HS2 being built that it's going to be a powerhouse of the UK. So they want control. But, you know, I was thinking, football clubs? What? But they are buying up all sorts of strange things, aren't they? And as we know, the government's fallen out with about Hawaii. Maybe that's the pressure from America as we're leaving the EU. We can speculate on that. They're building Hinkley Point Power Station for us with all sorts of other issues. We don't talk about worry on this program, but should we be a little bit concerned by this?
It depends, I think, probably whether you see yourself as a citizen of the planet or whether you see yourself as a citizen of an individual nation. If the former, probably not. This is part of a huge cycle. If the latter, and most of us probably would feel that we willy-nilly are part of the latter, then I think there is an issue. There is a concern, because one wants this to happen in an orderly fashion, if it's going to happen at all. And to go back to your point about the Chinese buying a whole lot of Midlands football companies. I'm not a football clubs. I'm not a football fan myself, and I doubt whether necessarily Tim's closely involved in it. But Tim will probably remember, even if he doesn't remember, he'll remember of the 50s and 60s, when frankly Americans were going all over the world buying up everything they could. And it was this, what we're witnessing is something I think dissimilar, Derek.
That's interesting. And we did that as well, didn't we? Let's be fair about it. Going back to the 19th century, the UK did it. So, yeah, that's maybe the shift in power. Let's clear a couple of questions in the chat box, Jeremy, if I may. Number one, digital technologies eliminate the need for banks to be involved in every transaction. Is that part of the central bank's concern? From John Lisby, an accountant.
Yeah, John, I think there is a concern there, and it's a justifiable one. Let me just try this on you, if you wouldn't mind. So a digital currency, the way to look at a digital currency is a bit like a drone. So let's say we have a digital pound, and that digital pound is a drone. And I want to pay you, John, for something. So I send this drone off. And this drone is loaded with information about you and me, as I was saying earlier on, about information about who you and I are and about the product or services we're exchanging between us. And that drone in its traveling along between us will be checking up on maybe the authority and the sort of regulatory structures that come behind it. It does not need to stop in a credit card house or in a bank. It can go straight from you to me. Now, where you put it when it arrives, or where I get it from when I try and pay you, is a different issue, and probably is a bank or a bank equivalent. So yes, there is a real...
Or a digital ledger, isn't it? Just stored in my digital ledger.
Yes. I mean, I think that's probably...
The bank isn't part of the transaction.
No. I think I've probably taken a bit of a leap, John, is that if I want assets like that properly looked after, I think I'd rather have somebody who I felt was fully regulated to look after it for me. I think I'm always going to find it difficult to leave that stuff either in some ledger I don't really know a great deal about, when really I just want someone of real responsibility, and that's the government probably in charge of the regulators who are in charge of the banks, so to speak, that's probably where I want that money kept. So I think I believe there will always be a role for banks. I mean, they're going to have to change their modus operandi quite dramatically over the course of the next decade or two. But I think most people are going to want to make sure that certain assets are kept in certain places. Maybe we shouldn't go on, because you then get into the fractionalization of assets and so on, Derek. But does
there's
that
lots of questions to keep going on the chat box, Jeremy, if that's okay. Yeah. Can I keep going? David Skinner, how does Bitcoin mining work? Doesn't this drive its market value? If so, who runs it? I bet that's a tricky one for you.
Yes, and I'm simply going to duck it, David Skinner. Thank you for the question. I have no idea in detail how mining works, but it's part of the massive cross-checking exercise that goes as you mine all the databases and information. I think, you know, it's simply not feasible in its purest sense as envisaged by, what was he called? I can't remember his name now, who invented Bitcoin. And so if for nothing else, that you could consume the entire energy of a city while you were busy, computer energy of a city, while you were busy trying to mine a particular transaction. I think that was the early stages of, you know, maybe it's not dissimilar to the first steam engines that came out. Maybe when the first steam engines came out, some of the ways in which they were going to operate were positively unrealistic. But modifications took place, and that's what's happened. So I think that the mining is important. It's an interesting component of it. But my read of it as a non-technologist is that it's moved slightly to the side, because the practical applications of this technology really either don't need it or can't afford it.
Okay, let's keep going. From Godfrey, since Africa has mismanaged or underestimated its natural resources, do you think China is seeing this and will exploit Africa even quicker than it's probably doing now, because we know it started doing that?
I think, where was that from? Godfrey?
Yep.
Yeah, Godfrey, I first of all, I probably should declare to you, I was brought up in Kenya, so I'm reasonably well au fait with life in Africa. Yes, is the answer to your question. I think China absolutely understands that that it has an opportunity there. I think the reason it understands that is because China has been overtly open towards the use of its wealth in enhancing the economic propositions and fundamentally the infrastructures across Africa, and they needed doing. And to some degree, America stopped doing it. Well, not to some degree, it did. It stopped doing it. And so China really stepped into a vacuum, which was very helpful. Now, you know, if I tell you from what I hear, that to give you a bit of a snapshot on the sentiment across Africa about China, the people I speak to in Kenya and in South Africa, where I've got some business connections, tell me that the general feeling is that the COVID virus didn't start in America at all. It didn't start in China at all. It started in America. And they're doing that because they feel, probably because they're listening to the Chinese, but they feel much more of an alliance with China in the next two or three decades going ahead. There are emotive issues about the amount of money they've been lent and have those countries ended up in hock to China. But you know, the Americans and the British did that significantly, major loans, soft loans they were called, I think, which they gave them, which didn't need to be and weren't forced in their repayment, but it was a good financial discipline to impose on those particular countries. So I think you're spot on, Godfrey, but it's I don't see, at the moment, the sentiment in that part of the world is by and large not resentful of what us in the West might see as Chinese dominance. That's not how they see it.
Brilliant, Jeremy. Let's change the subject slightly now to a more, perhaps a more interesting one. Or you were chairman of Bloomsbury Publishing, which had the privilege of publishing all the Harry Potter books. What was that like, chairing that company? And did you ever meet J.K. Rowling?
Yes, so that I don't forget it. Yes, I did, but not very often. Authors are wonderful people because they're simply not interested in the superstructure of their publishers. At least this is my view. So do they want to meet the chairman? No, not really. Do they want to meet the chief executive? Not particularly. They want to meet the editor. They want to meet the person, the midwife, who is going to give birth to their child, to their creation. And the second thing to say, Derek, is that I took on the role of chairman towards the end of the time when she stopped writing Harry Potter. So A, I can't take any credit for it. And B, I think one of the reasons I became chairman was because she stopped writing, and that caused a major strategic rethink in Bloomsbury. And it was part of that that we decided that it would be a good idea to split the role of chief executive and chairman, which used to be under one, under the founder, Nigel Newton, who's a very remarkable man, and split the two roles. So I can't claim any credit for the J.K. Rowling phenomenon, but what a phenomenon it was.
There must have been a worry about the profits if she'd stopped writing. Gee whiz, I bet people were arriving round her house with all sorts of ideas, etc.
Well, I think if you look at Bloomberg and look through the records, you'll see that you're not far wrong, Derek.
Yeah. How did Bloomsbury manage to sign J.K. Rowling? What a coup!
Well, it was, wasn't it? I mean, it absolutely was a coup. And again, it's a credit to a publishing company that had that vision. I mean, the folklore is that Nigel Newton's daughter, Nigel said, look, to his daughter, can you just read this, this manuscript? I'm not sure whether this is any good or not. And she came down the following morning, not having slept a wink, saying, this is amazing, Dad, you have to publish this. And that's how it began. And I think she'd been rejected by something between 12 and 20 publishers up until then.
Well, I think it's one of those stories like, how many failures did Edison have on inventing the light bulb? I think the story I heard was she was turned down by 62 publishers, but you never know quite how these stories get exaggerated, particularly for us professional speakers who always like an exaggerated story.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I suspect 12 to 20 is enough when you think you've created something lovely and everybody tells you it's rubbish.
Yeah.
Absolutely
right. She was persistent, wasn't she? I mean, the persistence of entrepreneurs like J.K. Rowling and the Body Shop lady, Anita Roddick, who I also met once. I was the account director. She was an interesting lady, and that's all I'd say. Couple more questions in the chat box. Anybody who's got any more questions, then we'll sum up. I'll stop the recording. And Jeremy, if you wouldn't mind staying on for any further questions, I'll unmute everybody if that's okay. Tim asks, is there a pressing coin shortage in the UK? Because there is in the US. Does it point to a cashless society? I would say, Tim, I've used no cash, hardly any, in the last 3 months. It's all touch of credit card on the machine because of COVID.
I mean that's a big issue. Cash, coin and bullion, so to speak, as if that's the right way to call it, has been on the way out for quite a while. But it's a long, slow process, and it will continue, in my view, to be long and slow and take time. On the one hand, and this is probably the significant thing, is these digital currencies can replace cash and can do so in such a way that they can direct with forensic accuracy money into the pockets of the people who need it. So when you get a pandemic like the one we've just got, where you need to get money quickly and fast into certain places and certain pockets, instead of, for example, relying on the banking system to do it for you, if you've got true mastery of the technology, you can get it straight to the hands of people who need the benefits or need some sort of form of subvention. However, on the other hand, there are not many, there is a constituency, there is a community of people who simply do not have the digital capacity to enable that to happen. And so the danger is, if you get rid of cash as it stands at the moment, you are excluding constituencies in society, and that clearly is wrong and bad, and rightly so in the democratic world. That frightens politicians, because politicians are saying, well, we're here to serve everybody. I think it's a bit different in China. I don't know for sure, but I think it is a bit different in China, where they have really forced the pace, not necessarily through government edict and diktat, but simply through the beauty and the smooth functionality of their new technologies and platforms like WeChat and the others, where all you have to have is a mobile telephone. And, you know, mobile telephones are held by almost everybody. To some degree, they are in this country as well, but in the West. But I think, therefore, that dynamic is moving forward. But no, it's a big issue. And the central banks know that, Tim. So their projects are all looking at that quite carefully and quite closely. The Whitechapel think tank is doing a response to the Bank of England on this, and that's an important component of it.
And you got some government sponsorship for it as well, didn't you? Or to at least pay the overheads, etc., and encourage people to join, I think you told me.
Well, in the form of you need a secretariat for something like that. The key is to keep it, at least to me it is, as the chairman, is to keep it as open as you possibly can. And therefore you don't exclude people by demanding subscriptions. But you do want people who are going to contribute. And you, of course, need a decent secretariat. And the City of London Corporation, which is, you know, the big enterprise that really keeps the financial square mile of London operating and going, they provide secretariat support. So does a thing called Innovate Finance, which is a government / City of London sponsored enterprise to encourage innovation in London and across the UK. So that's the help it gets. The government to just engage. I mean, they're there, and they do listen. There are some very heavyweight sponsors behind the Whitechapel think tank. There's a very remarkable peer called Lord Holmes. And he in particular wrote a paper called Distributed Ledger Technologies for Public Good in 2019, and that was directly aimed at the government, and the Whitechapel think tank basically helped him put that together. So it's a very
And do you think somebody like me with 3 GCSEs would have understood that paper? I doubt it, Jeremy.
Yeah, I think you might well have done. I mean, it had to be written for MPs, Derek. So you wouldn't have had any problem.
Well, it's about time we got an MP on here, actually, but I don't think they'd come. My questions might be more aggressive than Andrew Neil's, I don't know, particularly with the people on.
Who's that nice guy? You introduced me to a very nice MP about 5 or 6 years ago, youngish guy. Anyway, sorry, I don't want to distract you, Derek.
You mean James Duddridge, who used to work with some of us that worked for Barclays. Yeah, he's the MP for Southend East, and he's a junior minister now. I think he's the Minister for Africa. You might be interested in catching up with him. Anyway, Jeremy, we're out of time. Can I thank you very much for joining us? Can I thank you very much for answering some tricky questions, but also trying to help us understand where this technology is going. And if you'll stay on for a little while, I'll stop the recording and so if we could just raise our hands for Jeremy in the usual way, that would be absolutely brilliant. Thanks very much. So